So I want to say it's been wonderful to hear from you today. We can learn so much from each other, and we get encouragement from each other. And we're so used to like really trying so hard to accomplish something or to do it right. And I wanted to give you permission to approach this in a very not easy way, but with a great sense of ease, because that's a better way, a faster way, and a surer way that one can advance on the spiritual path. The seven consciousness that I was talking about, everybody knows what the six are, right? Okay. That, yes, it's the eye consciousness, the ear consciousness, the nose, you know, what we see here, taste, touch, smell, and think, and how we process that. And the storehouse, the manas consciousness is what gives us a perception of ego, individuality. And so it's the basis of human existence that joins name and form together, or objects and opinions and inner discursiveness. You know, that's why we call it the nuisance consciousness. And it's regarding the false as real. What is the false? It's the compounded aggregates of like our composition. They come together. If you take any one of them apart, there will no longer be a me. You know, if the earth element was missing, there wouldn't be a Panyawati. If the water element is missing, kaput. If the, you know, air element is missing, dead. All together, these aggregates form, this compounded form is a me. And it's going to break down into its simplest denominators. And when that comes, there will no longer be the me that I assume. So that's what's meant by false. It doesn't mean I'm not really sitting right here. There's not a me sitting here talking to a you sitting there. I'm real, you're real, we're all here. But it's like understanding that we're only here through the coming together of certain things that have produced this combination of phenomena that we call a human being. That's all I mean by false. And these practices that we do help break down that sense of concreteness, that which is false is real, and that it is permanent and unchanging, because it's changing every nanosecond. The eighth consciousness, which is the storehouse consciousness, Alaya consciousness, it stores impressions of previous experiences, which could be in this life or that came with the consciousness that is a part of one of the aggregates of this life that's called Panyawati. You know, so that there is that pre-lit candle of consciousness that meets together with other and forms another body, you know, and that body that's formed is going to be based on the resultant ripening seeds of previous existence, which we call karmic forces, that did not ripen or mature yet. So now a body is fashioned, and we come together to give expression to that. And that's how nature carries on. That's how the universe continues. So in the beginning, we do have to have we have to wake into some analysis or explanation of things And the Buddha says, don't try to go back to the beginnings. Anybody ever wondered, you know, because they talk about in beginningless time in Buddhism. When I came out of Christianity, we talked about in the beginning. There was a beginning. That seemed plausible to me for some reason. When I got to Buddhism, they talked about beginningless time. I said, how ridiculous that sounds. Of course, there had to be a beginning, you know, so, but a beginning, the notion of a beginning is just as ridiculous as the notion of beginninglessness. You know, both of them like leave a question mark. Like what still, what came before that? So Buddha said, don't even worry your little mind about that. He says, start with right where you are and just ask what came before that. You know, like what came before this last minute. And that's how we start to look at things, evaluate. Instead of wanting to jump all the way to the beginning, he said, you can't handle the answer, right? Okay, so we're not going to talk about that. We'll just start with me right here, right now. And as things are happening in my life, I'm looking at what came before that, what caused the opening for the arising of that, you know. And that's how I'm trying to figure out and understand life, you know, what came before that, all the way down to a baby, what came before that, the rebirth consciousness that linked with the egg and the sperm, and the three of them created a being. If there's no Gandhava rebirth linking consciousness, then you have a stillborn baby, because the life didn't stay. So it's not two things, it's three things. It's the sperm, the egg, and the rebirth linking consciousness, Gandhava, that creates life. That rebirth is linking something. So something is ripening now, and this is a body suitable for what's ripening. There's lots of things ripening, and there are going to be lots of things that we're producing right at this minute that's going to ripen, cause of the ripening of something that was not in existence. It's going to cause it to be in existence because of some decision I make today about something I do or something I say or something I think, and I will have watered some seed that's going to, you know, set forth in motion the ripening of something. You know, so that's the danger about being on the wheel of samsara. Like, how the hell can you get off? Because you're always doing something that's going to be a cause that produces a condition. You know, and you catch me on a bad day, I just make a big mistake, you know, but then it's done. So it's not even so much that there's this rebirth linking consciousness and stuff that, you know, that is ripening, but the potential for so much more that I'll never get off the wheel of samsara, you know, never get off. And so that's why I feel a sense of urgency. We should have a sense of urgency to get this and to get it right today, you know. And it's just with that kind of heart mind, you know, my practice goes to the forefront. I still want to do everything I want to do. Monastic or lay, you know, those are false designations. Okay? So don't think about them in that way. They're false designations. And it's just who wrote the book. It's just the monastic's story. They wrote the book. So they make themselves you know, tier one, and then the lay people are tier two. And then within monasticism, there were different groups of people, right? Although they didn't have a caste system or whatever, they came from a caste system. So caste was in them, you know? And so they have those who became his disciples who were Brahmin. When they had the convention or the council where they started trying to, you know, memorize everything he said, and later it would be reduced to writing. Well, they took charge of the council. So it's their story that got through, you know, and others felt like, well, we heard him say this, but they were in charge. Look, because in the society they were in charge. So we got their version. You know, the only way you're going to know that's not the only version is you're going to have to encounter the Dhamma directly. That's the only way you'll know how much, you know, expansion There is around that for your, you know, for your understanding and for you. You know? And so, but that's how it came, and it came down to be recorded, and why some things got in it and some things didn't get in it, and some things got in it in a certain way, like mostly all of them were against women having any kind of power at all, especially spiritual power. And so there's one passage in there that says, these are the things that cannot happen. A female could never be a Buddha. Like, I know he didn't say that, because what was the point in bringing me in if I couldn't go all the way? You know, we asked, could they ask, is it possible that a woman, you know, can take up this path? And he said, yeah. He said, that doesn't figure in what we're doing, okay? That doesn't. And so in that space of time, they couldn't conceive of a woman because they didn't give the woman any power. And so once he was gone, I read a little thing in there and said a woman could never attain. No, I said, I know he didn't say that. I'm like, you lie. Well, I didn't say that. But in my mind, I know that it's not true, you know. So so we have certain rules to kind of keep the order. They did it also in Jesus' time with the Jewish women, and as they were receiving insights and being set free, they were feeling so free. He said, look, you can't use your freedom as an occasion to sin, to create problems. So if you have any questions, ask your husband at home. You know, that's what they said. But the word for wife and woman was the same. So they made it women can't speak, you know. But he was talking to wives and saying, don't embarrass your husband by going up and asking another man that. I used to see it all the time in my church. All the women running behind the pastor, pastor, pastor. You know, and they got a husband there, and the husbands would be upset because, like, you pay more attention to him than you do to me. You know, like, maybe it's so, but don't, like, right in front of his face make it so obvious, because it feels disrespectful to the husband, especially if they are teaching him that he's the head of the household, you know. So it was talking about how to get along in a social context. You know, even as you're getting this wisdom, don't just go hog wild with it and, like, in your face to everybody. You know, I had an issue with that. I'm much, much better, you know. But in the beginning, like, I was fighting tooth and nail for my liberation. Wasn't nobody going to take it from me either. Certainly not you. You can send somebody else and he can try, but not you, you know. But now I'm not like that. I'm just giving you an example from past times. I'm not like that now, you know, because I have more understanding, and I can know how to answer them. First of all, I don't even have to answer them at all. You know, I don't feel compelled that I have to make an excuse for myself. I don't, or any other nuns, you know. So now it's just really become a non-issue. So if a nun comes crying to me about this and we ain't got that, like, girl, we already took care of that. Just go ahead and handle your business. I don't hear all that whining about, like, I'm so fragile and all that. Not fragile. When I didn't finish that story, but now that I know all of you, I will finish the story I told earlier about when the time when we started having allies. You know, homeless people had allies, black people had allies, blah blah, women had allies, so forth. So we got allies as black women. No, but here's the thing. I had two problems. The allies want to walk in the front. I'm like, you got to get behind us. We're in charge of this. We want your help. We need your help. But you got to get in the back this time. Okay? Don't treat me like I don't have a capacity. And, you know, like, you got to stand up for me. I need your support. But let me do my thing. You know? And so that was one issue. But the other is, all these black people start coming to me, you know? And they're, like, so fragile. I said, fragile? That ain't in our vocabulary. You know, I'm like, where you get that from? Well, they picked it up from the white allies, you know, because they were fragile. We had to be tough or we did not live. You know, and so that fragility thing came in on us. And I'm like, no, throw that back out. We're not fragile. And so it's all of these kinds of things. So with everything that comes, there is within all the good, there is also the not so good. And within things that are not so good, there are also some aspects that's good. So don't label anything as good or bad. You know, this is that non-differentiating mind that we have to develop. We have to cultivate, because we just make stuff black and white. We just make stuff high and low, in or out, rich or poor. It's always this or it's this. But he's saying you have to get to that space of non-differentiation. That is the middle way. That it is what it is, and you have to have the wisdom to know how to work with it. Not to label it and then go off the label of this is good and this is bad, because nothing is all any one thing. And when you start working in every aspect of your life with these kinds of notions, like seeing both sides of the coin, seeing the is and the isn't, seeing the emptiness of seeing the emptiness of self, and yet there is a fullness of self, a richness of self, then it is set aright for usefulness. And one can be confident in oneself. One can be equal in one's own mind to another. One doesn't have to feel that they don't have the capacity or the ability. One does no longer have to be afraid of and fear any other man or woman, or fear any other situation. Whether you win or you lose, you overcome the eight worldly winds of life. Praise, blame, loss, gain, pleasure, pain, fame, and shame. That's it. That's life. One of those eight things. And these are the things that we're constantly battling with, you know, and we ourselves have to overcome them for ourselves. But when you do, you teach another by your modeling, by your actions, how they also can do it. You give them the courage to be fully mature, lacking in no good thing. This is the Dharma. So we've learned it, or maybe we're learning it in a particular way, and we may have had an affinity for that because that's why we're here. We're learning it in a particular way. Go across town, there's another group of people, and they're learning the same Dharma, but in a particular way, from a particular angle that suits their personality and their propensities and their understanding and their level of interest. You know, and so they do something in a little different way. No, I come in here, I have a different one. But the good thing is I've been Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Now I'm just Buddhayana. It's just one thing. It's just one. He had one vehicle, you know. And so wherever I find something different, even radically different, I'm looking to see what is there in that like, you know, I'd like to prefer it this way. No, like the Zennies, I can't deal with it. You know, although I'm Zen, I can't deal with one of my nuns is Zen. I'm like, girl, please, you know, because everything is, there's like a plodding kind of slowness to everything. I'm like, you got to be able to move fast and slow, okay? And so it just doesn't work for me, you know, but it does work for her, you know. And sometimes when I'm explaining something, she's so confused about what I'm saying, and then I realize I'm trying to explain it to her in Vajrayana language. I need to explain it to her in Zen language. So then I'll go back and I'll explain it to her again. And so that's why for a teacher, you got to know all of these things, because people are going to come to you with, you know, in different ways, and they're not going to get it one way. They have to change up. I had to change up between last night and today, because I was talking to you as if you were Vajrayana people, and I'm solidifying. I'm looking like no clue what I'm talking about. Okay, so I have to change it today. And I thought about that last night, you know, before I could go to sleep. You know, because I'm not coming to hear myself talk. I can stay home and hear myself talk, you know, but I'm coming to like help you take the next step, or a step, take one step to the right, you know, one step to the left, so that you can pick up something else and drop it in your backpack. Or the one little missing piece. I like everything I'm doing just the way I'm doing it. But that one little piece is like, oh, what a golden nugget. And put that in your bag and keep going right where you are doing what you're doing. Don't have to hop over and change lineages and start over, because we don't have time to keep starting over. You have to keep going forward. And you can add a little bit here and a little bit there, you know, that enrich your personal experience. And that's all that a teacher should do, other than to live the life that they speak about in their words. That's it. Okay, so we're closing for tonight, and I want to preframe you for what tomorrow will be. Oh, you know, parting, it's going to be sweet sorrow, because now I'm full of you. Everyone is so familiar to me now. Well, that's all. So tomorrow we're going to be answering the question, how do you cause your original nature to emerge, this emptiness? I've given you a meditation practice, but I'd like to also give you a cultivation practice. And the answer to that is, we cause our original nature to emerge through utilizing precepts, meditation, dharmic wisdom, faith, vows, and practice, which would be preliminary practices. It would be generation and completion stage practices. And I'll just touch on that just a little bit, because those are not two of the practices that you do. But I'll be talking about the paramitas, and I know you all are undergoing a study on them, so I don't want to talk about them specifically, but I just want to talk about them being a part of the practices that one must, or the cultivation that one must take up, and the four Brahma Viharas. And you know, this is what I'll say in closing. The Brahma Viharas, what does that mean? Brahma Vihara. Divine abodes. Okay, so a lot of people think that the Brahma Viharas are in the Buddhic abodes, you know, but they're really not. The heavenly abodes are still within the three spheres, the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. So if we thought that heaven was, that they're speaking of, was in the pure lands, the pure abodes, it's not. Even the Brahma Viharas are still within the realm of the divine abodes, which is within samsara. Did you know that? And so if you thought that was taking you out of samsara, I want to clarify that for you tomorrow, so that would be more, so you have somewhere to go with that, okay?